Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is William Least Heat Moon, who reads from and discusses his new book, Roads to Quaz, An American Mosey, published by Little Brown. In the weeks to come, we have Randall Strauss, Liz Robbins, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you all for coming tonight. And I also want to thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. We're honored tonight to have author William Least Heat Moon here with his intriguing new book, Roads to Quaz, An American Mosey. And yes, Quaz is a word. Think peculiar, strange, absurd. Quaz can be history and heredity, stories retold or invented, and quirky characters with poignant dreams. For those of you who loved Blue Highways, Prairie Earth, River Horse, or Columbus in the Americas, your wait is over, and a new journey is about to begin on the roads to Quaz. Please help me welcome William Least Heat Moon.
I'm 2,000 miles into this book tour, and I want you to know that 1 mile of a book tour is equivalent to about 50 miles of a book tour. It's a different form of traveling, and I'm in Denver this afternoon. I thought, man, all these things I can do, and I was just too wiped out. So I lay around the Brown Palace, which is a pretty nice place to lie around in. You're feeling sorry for me, aren't you? Well, it's wonderful to be back in Denver. My first trip to Colorado was in 1952. And I see some of you were not yet on the planet at that point. And for some reason, I remember where we stayed. We were up near Estes Park, which was a really another world then from what you see now. And in a place called Tiny Town. We had a cabin in Tiny Town. Do some of you remember Tiny Town? It's still there? Oh, my heavens. Oh, they moved it? My mother didn't know about mountain air and sun in August, and she decided, being a Kansas girl, she decided to get a tan, and she rode back across Kansas with a sunburn across her thighs that she couldn't keep her skirt on and had to pull it up, which in those days was kind of a rakish thing to do. Early memories of Colorado. But it's great to be back in Denver. This is one of the cities I really love to come to for a number of reasons. It's a wonderful book town, not just because of the Tattered Cover. And as you know, this is the institution that did so much to change bookstores in America. When Joyce put in those sofas and did all these things that booksellers weren't supposed to do, my God, we have coffee next to a book. What is she thinking of? Barnes & Noble wouldn't touch a store now unless they had a few chairs, and they're not as many as you have here, and certainly not as funky and fun to sit on. But it's also a good book town for me because I do a lot of, most of the books I really want to buy tend to be out of print. And there are a couple of stores here that I try to hit every time I'm in Denver. One is the Hermitage, which is in Cherry Creek. And the other, which I think is slowly going out of business. Dan Larson used to be called, I guess it still is, but it's not in the phone book anymore, I discovered. Colorado Pioneer Books out on Broadway at 47th? 14th, I think. No, it was way out. 40, about 47th, 4700 block of Broadway. He's emptying his stock out, so if you like out-of-print books, you might find some good buys in there. Dan Larson. And a couple of those others that are no longer there, and there's this wonderful Mexican restaurant on the far, I won't say the far end, I think it's more or less the north end of Laramie. I used to love to go into. Oh, it was the real thing, unpretentious. A lot of people, if you were not Latino, might have been a little jumpy about going in there. I just loved that place. But as Larimer began rising from bottles, where you could buy a bottle of Mad Dog for a dollar to what it is now, I think it was called Manny's.
La Casa de Manuel.
What?
La Casa de Manuel.
That's it. Yeah. Do you remember that? It's gone. Isn't it gone now? And it looked the part. It was great. The light was not so good in there, but the food was. Back in the old days of Larimer, I did once buy a bottle of Mad Dog on Larimer for for 50 cents. That was in the 60s. You're New York got told that there might be 180, 200 people here tonight. And I said, well, I don't think so, but we can always hope. But the good thing is that the people are here, those of you who are coming out with all these distractions that we've had with the election, you're the dedicated ones. You're the ones that I really want to talk to. We don't have any filler in here. You're the ones I can count on. It's your faces that I do my best to remember when I'm writing a book. Because when I write, there is a reader in the room with me. The reader has no gender, has no age, no color, but there is a presence there. And so when I'm writing, I'm really writing to that person. I don't think it's conscious. It isn't that I'm thinking about it. It's just that as if there's somebody there, and as I write, that voice is hearing me. And I think if you find a conversational style in my writing, the reason is that I'm thinking of people like you. Changes. Golly. Coming up, I-25, which I haven't been on in a while. I try to avoid I-25 as best I can, at least anywhere near Denver. But it was late last night. It came up, and it had been a while since I'd been on it. We got on at Pueblo, and I was just stunned at how much light there is now when you go up there. It's just this wall of light. And at night, that's what you see instead of the mountains. I wish I could say I loved seeing that. It was pretty, but I just, forgive my opinion here, but I just thought, I don't want to see light here. I'd rather see the darkness of the mountains and maybe a few lights up in there. I try to do something a little different on the book tours to keep my mind alive, because a good bit of running a book tour is answering the same question again and again. And as you might guess, the first question with any interviewer, newspaper, radio, TV, whatever, is what is quas? And I knew that would happen by putting that word in the title. And I said once I get through those, it's really the title that I want. I'm sure that title is going to get trashed by a reviewer somewhere along the line. It hasn't happened yet, but I'm sure it's on the way, because I do often get in trouble for my vocabulary. And let me say this about vocabulary. I think this is probably not true of you, because you're here tonight. And if you didn't like words and peculiar words, which, as you know, I love, you wouldn't be here. But there are people who get just damn right hostile if you use a word that they don't know. An acquaintance of mine who wrote a review for the Kansas City Star in Missouri, and one of the early reviews that came out, I admire him for this. He confessed that he was irritated by the vocabulary in the book. Well, I addressed this, and I knew that was going to happen, so I addressed it. You'll find it. I think it's in the first chapter of the book, where I say we have the richest language in terms of vocabulary, of any language on earth. Our vocabulary is unmatched by any other language. Why would we then not want to use it? That would be like saying, okay, you can have this, you can drive a Cadillac, you can drive this beat-up car that really isn't running very well and is quite limited. Well, who would take that second car? We want the car that can do all these things, I would assume. We want a language that can express the subtleties that we really need to try to express, particularly if you're writing a book. So I try to put the word in that fits the subject. And yes, I'm sure that I'm guilty from time to time to putting a word in there that fits the subject, but also maybe a little arcane. I guess I write the way what I want to read. And when I come across words I don't know, I very seldom interrupt my reading to look the word up. I write it down or mark it in the book, and we'll look it up later. But there are a lot of them in this book, I'm afraid. But my suggestion is, if it's not unfair for a writer to give tips to readers how to read his book, jot them down as you go. Don't worry about too much of it. I think most of them will, the context will help you know what's going on. But don't get mad at me. Just keep going. It's not important. The other thing that I knew would bring some reviewers down on me. It's good to put some obvious things out in a book for reviewers to go after. Keep them off of the important things, like is the book any good or not. Let them pick away at these other things, because I think most good readers read a review and they know how to read it, and they say, well, this is a lot of opinion. My opinion may be different. But I knew they were going to go after what I was hinting at a few minutes ago about you. I address you in the book because, as I said, when I'm writing, a person is there. And the more and more that I read newspaper and magazine journalism, where you read a story and the reporter is saying to a reporter, so-and-so said, as a reporter came up, what this person is talking about herself or himself, just say, I was there. We know that news stories don't get written by computers yet. There's somebody there. Admit it. Say you're there. That doesn't change anything. Well, it does. It makes it more honest, it seems to me. So I thought, okay, we know there's a reader out there. We know that I'm writing to readers. I'm not writing to the wall. So let me address you. So I do. But again, some people may think, oh, this is quirky. All right. Can't deny that. One other tip on reading the book. I've never done this before in my life, but for the first time in my fifth book and 40 years of writing now, almost, I submitted part of the book to a committee to make an artistic decision. I do not believe in that. But this time I got into something that I thought, I think this might be the time to do it. If you've read the book, or if you soon will, and I hope you will, the current chapter 1 was my chapter 2. My chapter 2 is now the current chapter 1. And my editor, the first time he read the manuscript, which at that time I think was in the fifth draft, there were 10 drafts of this book, he said, really, you need to make chapter 2 chapter 1. And I, no. I knew you were going to say that, but no. I said chapter 2 is way too quirky. And when you read the book, you're going to find it is extremely quirky. It is eccentric. It is the most eccentric chapter in the book. If it puts you off, either keep reading quickly and get through it, it's not very long, or forget it and go on to chapter 2, my chapter 1, because it's quite different. I said, we don't want to drive people away with this oddball chapter 2. Well, so I held my ground. When he read the, I don't know, seventh draft, he said, I'm convinced even more that you really should put chapter 2 as chapter 1. So I said, okay, he's got enough doubts in my mind. So I Xeroxed the two chapters and gave unmarked the two chapters to seven friends, and I said, okay, read them and vote. And I got voted down. So I thought, all right, for one time in my life, I'm going to go against my artistic judgment and switch them. I think I'm glad now I did, but of course it helps when I can stand up and defend my decision, something I can't do across the country. But keep in mind, at one time there was my great editor who died not long ago, not the one I'm talking about just a few moments ago, another one, Jack Lezebnik, who without him I would have never been published. He really shaped my writing and taught me how to write. Lived in Columbia, Missouri, and taught at Stevens College there for years. He was one of the best editors I've ever seen. He could take some of my mangled prose, start turning a few words around. He did it so tactfully. I was never insulted by anything he did. He never took the so-called blue pencil and marked it through words. He would shift them around, and I'd read it. Good God, there was a good sentence in my sentence. After all, I had mangled this, but he turned this into something. So I tried to study what he did, and I had to write this book without him. If you don't like Roads to Quaz as well as anything else I've written, it's probably because I didn't have Jack this time. But he said when we were going over the manuscript of Blue Highways in the Ninth Street Deli in Columbia, Missouri in 1982, he said, this title's not very good. I don't like it. He said, I said, don't like Blue Highways? No. I said, well, give me another one. I had a list of 22 titles. And I thought of those. Let me give you a sample of one of them to let you know kind of what they were like. You ready? Don't write this down now because it's so embarrassing. And never repeat. No, I'm kidding. Don't ever repeat this story. One of the titles was, The Wind is Also a Rover. Have you heard a more pretentious, stupid, silly title? So I said, is that what you want? He said, no, that's terrible. I said, all right, what do you suggest? So we sat there for 45 minutes at the little table in the 9th Street Deli while he flipped through the manuscript of Blue Highways trying to find a phrase that he could take out and use as a title. And finally, we got to the last page. At that time, the manuscript was pushing 800 pages. It turned out finally to be 500. I cut 300 pages out of it. He said, okay, I can't do it now. I said, well, all right, if you find one, let me know. Well, he never did find one, and Blue Highways remained the title. He later, perhaps 2 years later, he finally admitted that had been his lone single editing mistake in working with my work. Yes, he finally admitted I was wrong about the title Blue Highways. Another close friend of mine was not an editor, but when he read the manuscript, he said, it shouldn't be Blue Highways, it should be Blue Highway, singular. And I thought about that a long time. As it turns out, there are many people who refer to the book as Blue Highway, so really it's got two titles on it. I think you're still with me, so I'm going to keep talking a little bit about writing here. I'm supposed to be talking about Quaz, but I've been working on this book for 4 years. I've mentioned to you 10 drafts, so you can imagine how, even though it's a child here, and I love it as a parent might, you don't want to talk about your kids all the time. But I thought you might be interested in this. What have I got in my pockets here? I'm often asked this question. That's why I'm talking about it. People want to know, when I'm on the road, do I write the books on the road? Do I begin them? Yes and no. The answer might be a little different from what you expect. But keep in mind now, this book, I didn't mean it to be this big, by the way. It was supposed to be smaller than Blue Highways. I'm getting old, and I wanted to write a smaller book. But these stories kept coming up, and these things that I wanted to share with you, so I kept putting them in. And also, I do not know how, on my laptop, to number consecutively from one file to another. So I didn't know. I knew how many pages were in each chapter. I didn't know what the total number was really without sitting down and adding them up. I didn't ever do that. So I had no idea it was going to be this big. I don't know whether you're happy about that or not, but too late now. What was I going to say? Oh, so this book, 585 pages or whatever it is, began with a bunch of little books like this. These are great little notebooks. Don't get the ones, if you're a writer, and I'm sure some of you are, don't get the ones made in Brazil, because if you're out in eastern Colorado, and I'm speaking of a particular instance, and you open your book up and take a note, and the wind catches those pages from out of Brazil, and whoop, there went 2 days' work, headed toward Kansas. But anyway, I carry this with me, and I'm taking notes, just reminders, so that when I sit down that night, I'll remember what to put in. There's no detail to speak of, just enough to remind, oh yes, that person said this, or that highway was here, whatever. So from these, then I go in the evening to the next morning to this. There were two of these for Quaz. I should have done this. I didn't do this with Blue Highways. I didn't know what I was doing writing Blue Highways. But what I found in keeping a good logbook, and I highly recommend this to anybody who wants to write, is if you start taking time to make it into a real journal. I mean, I put pictures in here to help remember what's going on. If you make it into a real book, you start believing in what you're doing. That's one of the hardest things in writing. I don't care whether you've been published before or not. Just believing in what you're doing and knowing that you're going to have all these people out there and that a good number of them are going to be not really very friendly with what you're doing. You're going to have people who are looking for any mistake you make, looking for the weaknesses in your writing. So you got to believe in yourself when nobody else does. But, here... Put a whole map in here. That's of Edisto Island, South Carolina, which is not in the book. A lot of things never make it, of course. And these I find when I get home, they inspire me. Now, if I read you a page from this to the equivalent passage in the book, would it match up? I don't think so. Maybe you could recognize it, but probably not. The prose is radically different. But when I get home and I can really focus and things are quiet and I'm in the place where I like to write on the second floor of our house, then my mind can work with this and take its time and really start turning things. And that's when this begins to happen. And that's when I feel like I'm really no longer who I was when I was doing this. The man who writes these two things, you all know I have two names. The man who writes these is William Trogdon. The man who turns this into Quaz is Heat Moon. And he's somebody that he's present only when I'm writing. Otherwise, he's not there. You're talking now. You're hearing from William Trogdon. This is not Heat Moon. So he said, God, the man is psychotic. Well, art in many ways probably is psychosis. The three things that all begin with the letter Q. By the way, if you don't like the letter Q, have I said that? See, this is what happens. Where am I today? Denver. Have I talked about the letter Q? Lots of Qs in this book. I think they're important. Anyway, let me tell you about three of them, which are truly important to comprehending the book. And I should say this. The book's been treated very well so far by reviewers. I very seldom have trouble with reviewers. Oh, there'll be two or three with each book who will go after something. Usually they go after me. John Updike, in his review of Blue Highways in The New Yorker in 1983, talked about the shape of my stomach. John, what are you doing? What are you thinking of? Anyway, the reviews so far, nobody has really understood what the book is about. And very seldom will reviewers, as opposed to a critic who will take more time and work with your work at length. Reviewers are the ones who come on first. Most of them have to get the review done quickly. They have to read quickly. And the book that they're reading many times is a bastard version of what the finished book is. The book that many of the reviewers read is missing the last six pages of the book. And I told them, don't do this. Don't send that out. But I lost that argument, too. Anyway, here are three things that I don't think any reviewer, except for a little bit about the first Q, Quaz, has mentioned. I'm going to do that one last. First, let me say this. If you have a book, and if you lift the dust jacket and look at the hardcover, you'll notice there's an embossed figure there. You can feel it. You can probably feel it better than you can see it. It's a design element that appears later in the book. It's a quilt pattern, one of the squares of a quilt. And it's called, at least initially, it was called Wandering Foot. And there was a superstition, a kind of legend about Wandering Foot, that if you put a young person under a quilt with the Wandering Foot pattern, that child would end up wandering west and you would never hear from that child again. Now, some of you who have children are probably thinking, damn, why didn't I know about that some years ago? And I don't know what this says about me and my parents, but they put me under one. And sure enough, I ended up wandering west and to every other point of the compass. With that superstition in there about the wandering foot, they changed the name to Turkey Tracks. And if you look at the pattern, if you know what a turkey track looks like, you know, it's three. There's a picture of turkey tracks in the book, too, kind of three prongs. But that seemed too coarse, I guess, and it later became known as flying corners and flying swallows. And if with some imagination, you look at that pattern, you can see all those figures in there. But the odd thing to me, when these images of quilts and quaz and another Q word I'm going to use started coming together when I was writing the book, is that the woman who made that quilt that I slept under with the turkey tracks on it, the wandering feet on it, which I still have and I still sleep under and I'm still wandering, was my great-grandmother who, incidentally, saw Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg. She grew up near Reading, Pennsylvania, and she got in a covered wagon sometime not long after the Civil War and came west and settled down in the Missouri Ozarks and began making quilts. And I still have this one from her. But she raised turkeys. When I was 1 year old in 1940 and began to walk, the first time that I got up on my feet and started walking was in an attempt to chased down two of her turkeys, and you'll see a photograph in the book. The photographic reproduction in this book, I'm afraid, is not very good, but it's, you get kind of a muddy photograph, but you can see this little kid in a dress. That's another story, which is me taking my first steps in pursuit of these turkeys. So I was thinking, turkey tracks, wandering feet, what I'm doing. And then her name was Mary. When Mary lost her eldest grandson in World War II to shrapnel, he was a tail gunner, and he got hit with shrapnel over Holland in 1945. The war was about 2 weeks from being over. He got shot down. But I was thinking, I was writing, one of the newer names of this quilt pattern is Flying Corners. And I thought, yeah, he got brought down by flying corners of steel. She stopped making wandering feet, turkey tracks, and she started making a pattern called Basket, I think it's Basket Weave. It's in the book. And it has another name. But these are names of stasis and security. All of this one stuff, she just stopped. I thought, okay, I have something here going with quilts, and that led me to a key theme in the book, which, again, no reviewer has yet talked about, but it's the reason I wrote the book. It has to do with tracks and traces. It seems to me that the thing that we're lacking, one of many things we're lacking today in America, is that we've gotten away somewhat from being conscious and dedicated to leaving something behind for, to use an Indian phrase, the seventh generation, the ones coming along behind us. What are we doing today that was going to leave any kind of track that will be at all important to somebody coming along behind us? How many days do we go through that once we've gone through that day, there's not a single thing left behind? Well, that's the nature of life most of the time. But Roads to Quads began with my wish to travel and meet people who were coming up with individual, distinctive, unique, idiosyncratic ways to leave traces behind. So, for example, you're going to meet in there Frank Brusca, who has spent 30 years trying to photograph every mile of U.S. Highway 40. He thought it was going to be a two-year project. And by the way, one of his favorite places on the high, on Route 40 is his Berthoud Pass here. He loves it up there. And you'll read about Denver in Quaz, because he kept moving from Baltimore, where he grew up, to Denver. He loved the mountains. He loved Denver. He did not want to go back to Baltimore. His parents were here, I don't know, a couple, 3 years. They moved back to Baltimore. He was terribly homesick, even though he was a Baltimore Chesapeake boy, for the mountains. So he found a book by George Stewart called U.S. Highway 40, which is photographs of Highway 40 from one end of it to the other, from California to Maryland, sea to sea, really. So he saw this and had photographs, and there's a beautiful photograph in there of Berthoud Pass. So he checked the book out of the library, took it home, left it on the coffee table, open to that photograph, with the idea that he would make his parents homesick for the mountains. It didn't work, but something else happened, and his father got a change. He worked for the government at that time, I think, in computers, early computers. Got a change, and they came back to Denver. Then they, 2 years later, they went back to Baltimore, so he checked the book out again and would leave it open on the coffee table. Well, what happened, his parents didn't pay much attention, but he did, and so he developed this love affair with Highway 40, and as I'm sure many of you know, it does cross right through Colorado. And when you get out near Craig, there are places there where you can see the old 40 just wonderfully showing up from the new 40. It's really a nice piece of highway archaeology. But Frank is leaving traces behind by photographing these miles, and now it's not simple. It started out just a simple photograph, but now he's using digital cameras with 360-degree panoramas. So his camera sits there, and it makes 360 degrees. He said, I always wanted to know what was behind a George Stewart photograph. He said, with my books, with my photographs, nobody ever wondered that. We'll know. You'll meet a man... in a similar way, who is photographing every mile of the Ouachita River, which runs from almost the Oklahoma border in Arkansas, though, through Arkansas down to Louisiana, where it meets almost meets the Mississippi River. There's a man in the northeastern corner of Pennsylvania, William Young, who has devoted his life to studying, essentially, he does other things, but this is the key, one single bridge not far from where he grew up, near Starucka, Pennsylvania. If you've never seen the Starucka Bridge and you happen to be back that way, it's well worth going out of your way to see this thing. I did a drawing of it. You'll see that in the book, but my drawing can't match what the bridge is. It looks like a Roman aqueduct. It's stone. It was put up in 1848, and it's still functioning. It was made to carry 50-ton locomotives max, and now it can carry two 200-ton locomotives if need be. It's an amazing piece of architecture. Beautiful, lovely, fascinating. But it's hidden off in this corner, so most people don't know about it. So his life, he is devoted to putting the history down of the Starucka Viaduct. So William Young, he's in his mid-70s now. When he joins the choir silent, he's left some tracks behind that will mean something to other people. Well, you catch my drift here, what I'm saying. Those are the people I wanted to find. And I did find a number of them. I wish I'd found more, but enough, I guess. Let me talk about another Q word. This is a word that I think originally came from the old cattlemen in Texas, the old vaqueros, the Hispanic cattlemen. They use a word, querencia, which comes from a Spanish verb meaning to love. The way they used the word was that a querencia was a place where a longhorn was born and where it really felt this was its territory. And I think that term is also used in bullfighting in Spain and maybe Mexico. It's the place in the ring, so I've read, never seen a bullfight. I always choose for, you can imagine just who I'd be choosing for in a bullfight. A place where in the ring that the bull takes as its own, and it really wants to protect that spot. So I suppose, and I'm making this up now, I mean, this is my interpretation, I suppose that the fight really is about the bull defending its querencia. Well, it seems to me that as we've gotten more and more removed from the landscape, as we become more and more urban dwellers, more and more linked through electronics, that we're getting some pretty thin connections between us and the landscape, between us and our native querencia. So this book, Roads to Quaz, is very much about places where a person belongs. Belonging, very important in this book, and the other word that I want to emphasize is connections. I think if you had to reduce everything that I've written down to one word, and I had to pick what that word would be, it would be connections. Let me say it this way. My own ethical philosophy is I don't know if I can call it philosophy, that's too formal. My own ethical thoughts and inclinations all have to do with connections. When we start connecting, I think we behave better. Let me give you one example. Well, I'm going to may give you several because I love this topic. But one is, what if George Bush had sat down without preconditions? Do you remember during the debates how preconditions became a dirty word? Can you imagine having, if you're married or if you've had children, you're going to have a serious discussion on topics you don't agree with, and somebody starts setting preconditions? That talk's going to go a long way, right? It's over before it begins. You can't do, we're talking diplomacy here. Preconditions, at any rate. Is anybody happy about the election results, by the way? anybody unhappy about the election results? You got to be. Are you? Okay. All right, I'll try not to be offensive, okay? I mean, the thing to do now is to come together and connect with each other. But anyway, I just want to say, if George Bush had sat down with Saddam before the bombs went, I don't know whether anything would have been different or not, but I can't see that it would have hurt anything. I think it would have been worth a try. And the same way now with anybody we think we're enemies with, Iran, I don't care who it is. Why not sit down and talk? If it ends up in a fist fight, well, that's better than a war, but I doubt that's going to happen. But connections. I think if Adolf Hitler had on a picture on one of his walls of Anne Frank, the Jewish girl who wrote that marvelous diary when she was sequestered in the attic in Amsterdam. I hope you've read the diary of Anne Frank. It's such a powerful book, timeless. I think, and she was such an attractive girl, 12 when she died in a concentration camp, if you don't know. If he'd had a picture of Anne Frank on the wall and underneath it, Himmler, somebody had put up a little sticky note there that said, "This is your enemy," I don't think he could have proceeded very well in pursuing that war, and certainly the concentration camps. Again, there's no connection there. When we disconnect, we can do all sorts of things that we would not do when we're connecting. It's the same way when we're driving. We do things that we would never do on the sidewalk when we're walking because we're disconnected in cars. How many times have you honked at somebody in an angry way in a car? Never mind. How many times when you've been on the sidewalk and somebody has bumped you, have you done a verbal honk at them? I think I could count on one hand the times that's happened. We've got a connection there. Well, I'm speaking especially about connections with the land. And I'm really worried, concerned about young people because I think their connections with the land is getting ever slimmer. Electronic connections, which have their use and are great, I'm not opposed to them, but we must not forget the ones that we have evolutionary experience with. Those are the ones that I think really count. And it seems to me that the highest journey of all is a journey, a trip, in which some kind of connection occurs. And when I travel, it's really all about trying to make connections. Sometimes it's nothing more than three or four words exchanged. But if I connect with somebody in Alabama for 45 seconds, I'm never going to think about Alabama in probably quite the same way, for better or for worse. There's one section in, speaking of connections, in Quaz, it just crosses my mind, where crossing North Dakota, one of the several times I've crossed North Dakota, to keep my mind from giving out completely, the Great Plains are, this is in the book too, Great Plains are a real challenge when you decide to cross them, particularly if you're alone. I'll either repeat conversations that I've heard that morning or that afternoon, or I'll come up with some little problem to keep me going. And when I say this, I want you to understand that I've been in every county in the United States, the 48 states, every county, 3,170 of them. North Dakota is not as hard to do as Texas, other than because you can drive, you can start down one, take a latitudinal course across North Dakota, and you can hit every county between Minnesota and Montana. You can turn around, go up 35 miles, and come back that way. But of course, your mind starts. No, I didn't do it that way, but. In theory, that's it. So one of my problems in North Dakota was, I wonder how many people in my lifetime, let's say if I lived to be, I think I took a high number because I wanted to get a high total, a high age. I said, what if I lived to be 90? How many people will I have had an exchange with, that meaning some kind of way in which for a moment we recognized each other? It could be anything from a passing motorist waving, you know, in Texas. They go down the road, they got the wheel, and you get the two-fingered wave. That counts. That's one. And my wife counts just as one also. So you count any person that you've had a momentary exchange with at just one time. Okay, how many would that be? So I made an estimate, which got me halfway across North Dakota. And I was so disappointed with the number because I came up with something just a little bit under 100,000 over 90 years. There are 300 million plus people today in America, so 100,000, that's pretty small. And I'm on the road all the time, and when I'm on the road, I'm reasonably gregarious. I make a point of talking to people, and I'm thinking of people who don't do that. Gosh, their number must be 20,000, 50,000. I thought, that's really not very good. We need to meet more people. I don't know whether you can or not. Are we at 45 people in here, Lisa? Is that about what you count? Are we up to 50 now? 55? All right, so I probably won't count 55 because some of you are not going to have any exchange with me except by eyeballs. But most of you, probably before you go, will have a little exchange. So I've just kicked my number by, say, 50. I feel good about doing it. In fact, that's the reason I'm here tonight. I just wanted to move my number up. Let me say this about Quaz. I don't want to go too far because I think Quaz is something for you, the reader, to discover and to expand and interpret and make it your own. If you've read my second book, Prairie Earth, you know it's a challenging book. It's a book in which there's no middle ground. People hate Prairie Earth or they love it. Nobody ever said, oh, it's all right. It's why did you write that book? Or it's, I love that book. I won't tell you which group is in the ascendance here because my ego wouldn't withstand it, I think. But now I've lost my train of thought. This happens sometimes. With Quaz, you'll know this from reading the book, but just let me say this quickly. I didn't make the word up. If you look in the Webster's, Merriam-Webster's Second International Dictionary, that marvelous fat one, which has been revised to the Third International. I think it's maybe in the fourth now. It's that big fat one that used to be on pedestals in the old libraries. If you look in there, you'll find Quaz. Well, that's where I found it because I was... It's hard for me to reconstruct the history. This happened a couple of years ago. But I was looking in the book for Q words because I was realizing this Q as a concept, as a letter and as a concept, was starting to shape the direction of the book. So I read every entry in the Merriam-Webster Second International of Q. And you think, oh, my God, I'm doing Q here. I'm not doing R or P. So it didn't take long. But the last word in there was Quaz. And I thought, what a marvelous word. And then I began reading about it and thinking about it, and finally it dawned on me, these trips that Q, my wife, and I are taking really are pursuits for Quaz, for mystery, for the unknown. And you'll see as you go through Roads to Quaz that the meaning keeps changing. By changing, I mean it keeps, I hope, I intend it to anyway, enlarging. And as I say, as you go, you're going to apply your own meanings to this. Let me say two more things about it. I think the essence of it has two aspects. One is that it's possessed of the fecundity of the unexpected. Fecundity, you know, a natural richness that we don't expect, that goes on to create something else. The fecundity of soil, creating a plant that you didn't know was going to come up in your garden. What is this little thing? Oh, my God, look what it's become. Which reminds me, this spring, a plant, I'm off the subject now slightly. But if you read my books, you know, I specialize in that. the reviewers love to go after that one. In fact, you'll find in this book, I hope I can get back to the little plant. If I say, where is it going, we say little plant. There are something in the book I call reader alerts. So if you are a I-25 driver and you want nothing to do with Colorado 109, do you know Colorado 109? I think Q is going to mention that. If you're a freeway speed reader, my books are probably not your kind of books. But I tried to help a little bit, good guy that I am, by putting in reader alerts, so that when I'm going to go, here I go, there he goes off in a digression, you have an alert and I tell you, okay, skip down three paragraphs to pick up the story again. And I'm going to be interested if I get letters from anybody saying, hey, I did that, I got through your book in 2 days. I think you're not getting your money's worth, though. Lawrence Stern and Tristram Shandy, and I quote him in the book, in my book, he says that if you take the digressions out of Tristram Shandy, you might as well take the whole book. And if you've read Tristram Shandy, you know what he means. Well, I think that's something true of Roads to Quaz, and maybe everything I've written. If you take the digressions out, what's left? Don't you think that your life really is more about the digressions in your life than the freeway course to your destination? Mine has been. Man, it's all over here. Maybe I'm going this way, but it's like that. So fecundity of the unexpected. The other phrase I'd like to leave with you, I should have put this in the book, but it only came to me after I'd finished the book and it was already in print. I should have said this phrase, which I think is so important, and I got this from a writer who died some years ago, Christopher Morley, in his book, The Haunted Bookshop. He speaks of books as silent and persistent energy. And I thought, that's one of the most beautiful definitions of a book that I've ever heard. Silent and persistent energy. That's what a good book is. It's this energy lying on the table, in the shelf, next to your bedside, under your bed, wherever it is. And it's energy waiting without making any noise. It doesn't require any fuel. It doesn't give off a carbon footprint. Well, it did one time. Carbon footprint, you open it up and there's that energy. All it needs is the energy within your brain to start working. And, of course, we're talking about connections again. And I'm speaking really of a book as a kind of Quaz, something that you make into something new. So remember Quaz as well as books as silent and persistent energy. All right. I want to do something completely different now. I'm doing this just because I enjoy these. And you know, they're not paying me to do this, so I have to do something up here that's sort of fun. I think you might like this one. I get a lot of letters, and I used to think about, you know, who's behind these letters? And I finally got a really nice approach to it from Mark Twain, who said one time, I don't think he wrote this, but he said it in one of his presentations, that when he read letters from, keep in mind we're talking about 1870, 1860, well, 1870, 1880. He said that in the letters that he received, he detected a lot of affection in them. And I thought, yeah, that's true. Yes, I get some letters that are not affectionate. I had one about River Horse from a highway patrolman in Pennsylvania who took umbrage. I'm not sure why, but I'd mentioned one of my co-pilots in River Horse carrying a loaded pistol, which I didn't know until he left our cruise. And all I say in the book is that when I saw him packing his luggage and here was this big loaded pistol, I said, "Have you had that all along?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Why do you carry a pistol?" He said, "I don't know what we're going to meet down along the river." Oh, so that's all that's in the book. Well, this highway patrolman told me, "Please come up to my front door," and he gave me his address in Pennsylvania, northeastern Pennsylvania, "and knock on the door and we'll talk about loaded pistols." I haven't visited him. Anyway, so I detect a lot of affection. I think even in these, or at least I'd like to tell myself. Let me read you two or three of them here. I'm not the whole letter, just the opening. "Dear Heat Moon, your new book is one of the dullest things I've ever read. Trust me, I read every word of it. I even read portions of it to my wife so she could see how dull it was." I think the word for people like this may be anal compulsive. I wanted to say, why do you keep reading if you don't like it?
Masochistic,
yes. "Heat Moon, forgive this long letter for taking up your time, but I have the odd habit of reading your books." That's a way to get a writer to keep reading your letter. "Dear Mr. Heat Moon, I'm eager for your next book, so please hurry up with it. I got your last book at a garage sale for a dime. And you know how long it takes before things get to a garage sale." One last one. "Dear Mr. Heat Moon, I find your book about traveling around America to be one of the finest and most well-written books I've ever read. But what have you written since Travels with Charlie?" At a talk 3 days ago in Austin, a fellow confused me with Bill Bryson. And he said, "You lost a lot of weight." And I said, "No." He said, "I've seen your picture. You're a big, burly, barrel-chested guy with a grizzled beard." And I said, "Well, it wasn't me. I did have a beard for a while, but it wasn't me." And he didn't believe me. The last thing he said is, we had a microphone, then people would go to the microphone and ask questions. The last thing he said as he was walking to his seat, he said, "Well, anyway, that photograph makes you look fat." And another fellow said, "What happened to your dog?" And I said, "Well, my dog died in 1948. I've not written about Doc." He said, "Yeah, you took a trip with the dog." And I said, "No, believe me, I haven't written about any dogs taking trips." He said, "I have the book at home." I said, "I think you may be thinking with Travels with Charlie and John Steinbeck and his dog." He said, no, I know Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie." He said, "That isn't it." After the talk was over and I was back in the quarters, it dawned on me, he was talking about Peter Jenkins and A Walk Across America, which some of you may have read. So, where am I going now with this? Let's see. Oh, The Little Plant. See, thank you, yeah. I used to do that occasionally with my students, but they weren't old enough to understand that when you get a little older, sometimes you need a little help getting back to the topic. They just think you're incompetent and senile, which I wouldn't want to argue that point. The Little Plant. Yeah, this has nothing to do really with what we're talking about, but I found it interesting. This spring, a little plant came up outside the kitchen window, and I have sympathy for anything that's little and growing alive, so I try to let them grow until I see what they are. And it got prettier and prettier, and it started looking like marijuana. And as far as we live out in the county on what was an old tobacco farm that I'm returning to forest, and I said, this would be news if Heat Moon was caught raising marijuana, but I want to see if that's what it was. Well, as it got bigger, it's clear that it wasn't. But it got bigger and bigger. Finally, it was taller than I am. Not too hard to do, but it did it. And it was just a lovely plant. And then about a month ago, it started fluorescing. And it was covered with small white blossoms. It was really very attractive. I cut off one limb and took it and put it in the house and got out my books and started identifying it, which wasn't easy because the blossoms were so tiny. It was a challenge, but I finally did it. I found out that it was water hemlock. Any of you botanists in here will know, water hemlock, according to one of my books, is the most toxic plant in all of North America, coming up under the kitchen window. And then we found that one side of the pond, which is against some woods, was absolutely covered with water hemlock. And I've always been interested in suicide, and I thought, well, I mean, when the time comes, you know, I want to weigh things a bit. I thought, well, Socrates and the hemlock. Fortunately, one of the books said this is not the way to go. This is not what Socrates used. He used a different form of hemlock. And then it described Indian children taking stems of water hemlock. I am way off the topic here. Stems of water hemlock because they're hollow and using them as kind of pea shooters. And the children would become ill and frequently died just from taking in that little bit from the stem. But they were quite sick before they died, unlike if you believe Plato's account of Socrates' death. Okay, for something now even more different, I would like you, for just a few minutes, to meet a character you're going to meet in the book, the woman Q. So as you read about Q, you can see I did not make her up. This is my wife, Joanne, who in the book is Q.
What a segue from water hemlock to me. No. 25 years ago, when I first read Blue Highways, I came away with a couple of questions, never imagining that the answers would come years later from traveling with Will as his wife. Oh, by the way, our first trip together, we went to Glenwood Springs here in Colorado to attend a wedding. Oh, it was lovely. We stayed at that, I don't remember the name of it, the old hotel. Yes, I think Teddy Roosevelt had a connection. Was that it? Oh, gosh, yeah, it was wonderful. Well, the first question was, how does he get people to talk? As they open up, you know, in Blue Highways, the profiles there. Well, these are young people, old people, black, white, you know, men, women, all telling him their stories, opening up in total confidence with him. Well, this is what my travels, you know, with him have taught me, that the answer came from just seeing what goes on. He's genuinely curious and observant. When he goes up to people, he asks good questions which draw them out. He listens well and in good humor, and he's never afraid to ask what might seem like a dumb question. If you remember the television show, the Saturday Night Mystery called Columbo, Peter Falk played the detective who in every show would, you know, interview people who it turned out to be the person who had done it. And he would ask them questions, and they'd always come away thinking he wasn't too bright, but yeah. But that's the approach to take, you know, to ask questions and to keep asking until you understand what the answer is, and, you know, in a nice way. Will has a maxim which he's taken to heart from Ralph Waldo Emerson, and that is that others are his master in the sense of teacher, that he can learn something from everyone, and that I think it gets people's confidence too, and, you know, gets them talking. And sometimes this just doesn't work, so he'll move on. There is a particular story in the book in the first section about an artist, a muralist we met. He calls himself Indigo Rocket, and one of the best interviews, the best encounters in the book, came from just a little conversation with this muralist as he was working. And I think he felt so comfortable and liked the conversation so much that as he was working up on a ladder, he called down, "Oh, by the way, if you don't have a place to stay tonight, come on out to the lake and you can stay in the cabin." We took him up on it, and now you can read about it in the book, but it really was a wonderful encounter. The second question is, what's traveling with Will like? Well, it's different really from my travel experiences before, and that is, if there really are no time constraints to the travel, and many times there are, but if there aren't, we like to explore, and that is not to get just from A to B in the shortest time possible, but to go around and to see what, you know, what there might be. in order to learn about the terrain and the history. We always go by daylight if we can. And Will usually checks the route by a 1966 Rand McNally Road Atlas, which he marks. He uses a yellow highlighter, and it has highlights for the routes he's taken since the late 40s to the present. So as you can imagine, it's quite full. I mean, it's all tangled with these yellow marks, but not all the roads are marked. So we seek out those roads which are not, and so that when we're finished, then he can fill in the yellow marks. Well, this Colorado 109 was one of those. We took it yesterday on the way here. It started. We entered the state in the southeastern part, and then came up and got on 109 and followed it up to La Junta. And along the way, we saw some lovely low mountains I had no idea were there. We also saw a coyote racing across the road. We didn't see what it was racing after, but in where we live, we don't see coyotes too often. And we saw a huge buck, a white-tailed deer. Yeah, luckily just standing there by the side of the road, wasn't moving. But you know, it was quite rewarding just to take 109, and then at La Junta, and then we cut over and we got on 25 and came up that way. But 109 was a classic blue highway, and it was quite rewarding to take it. Now, any inconvenience in taking these kind of out-of-the-way roads is more than offset by the chance to find good regional cuisine. Sometimes along the way, we do see, you know, sometimes little handmade signs, hand-lettered signs, too, or for things like boiled peanuts, which I'd never had before, fell in love with, or things with kind of quirky names. Frogmore stew was one which I've just fallen in love with. That's in the southeast. No, there are no frogs in Frogmore stew. But it contains, let's see, shrimp and grits and kielbasa. And I'm sure I would not have had it had we not gotten off the major roads. Pickle pie out west in Utah we had last year. We kind of found it in the same way. But for every culinary epiphany like those, there's probably a half a dozen meals which just aren't that great. One that really comes to mind was we were in Cornelius, North Carolina, earlier this year. And we were having breakfast. It looked like just a standard breakfast place. And there was only one thing that stood out on the menus that we hadn't seen before. Liver mush. So, yes. So we'll ask the waitress, well, what do you think of the liver mush? And she said, oh, it's wonderful. And she went on and on about how good she thought it was. So to get some standard for comparing it, he said, well, can you compare it with the sushi place right across the street? We'd been there the night before and had excellent sushi. And she said, I'd rather die than eat sushi. You'd never catch me eating that stuff, but I could eat liver mush every day. So taking that as, you know, a pretty high recommendation, we ordered liver mush. Well, we had maybe two bites, and that was all. And we were tasting liver mush for the rest of the day. And I should have known that would happen because on the Blue Highways trip, Will took along a tin of chopped liver that was given him by a friend. Never quite got around to eating it. So, anyhow, I'll give you back to him. Thank you.
Those of you who read Blue Highways in 1983 or soon thereafter remember that I was this lonely, out-of-a-marriage fellow, wondering why I was alive, and I managed in some way to hang on, and you see that my roads, my Blue Highways have led me to a better life. One of the viewers said that the difference is, one of the differences between Blue Highways and Roads to Quaz is that I'm more content now. Well, maybe so. But I want to close, and I hope you'll have a few questions. I want to close with a more serious thought, which really isn't one about contentment, but it is a question. But Buckminster Fuller, the architect and inventor, he died the year Blue Highways came out. It just crosses my mind. But sometime before that, I guess in the late 60s or 70s, he said, keep in mind, we're talking about more than a generation ago. He said, in the 21st century, we're going to find out whether humanity is a failed experiment. And if you go back, and many of you were alive in the 60s, and you remember what the world was like then, what our issues were that we were worried about, what we were concerned about, and you think about some of the things we're concerned about now, I'm not sure that I feel any better about the answer, possible answer to that question than I did then. I am an optimist, and I always hope. But I have to confess to you, I have a feeling that humanity is going to take that question right to the edge. I don't think we're going to be smart enough to start making sure the answer goes the way that we want when it's easier. Certainly if you look at climate change, we're taking that one very close to the edge right now, and we still have people who don't believe in global warming, or at least that it's man-made, humanly made. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Randall Strauss, Liz Robbins, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on November 5th, 2008.